preposterous, while Trump and top advisors smiled approvingly. This is an appalling violation of law and of justice that must not be allowed to stand. If Kilmer Abrego Garcia can be disappeared in this way, none of us is safe. This is Dennis Williams with a WPFW editorial.
I'm Kamaya.
I'm Amira.
I'm Kaya.
I'm Kamaya.
And you're listening to WPFW Washington.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Got your mask.
Oh, no.
What'd I do?
Okay,
turn around.
Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty. 10 years.
What? Come on. Get that.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning, and welcome to Crossroads. We come to you every Tuesday. At the same time in the same station here at WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. WPFW is heard around the world. So for those folks who've been listening and calling us and emailing us, thank you. We had no idea that our reach would be this far globally. So thank you for tuning in to Crossroads. As we always do, we open up with what we call the grapevine, information that you could use. The grapevine. Hey. First things first, we went to a party last week, Martina and I, at Miss Karen Robinson's Carney house, and it was an educational experience. We found out about a school that was called the Rosewald School. It was 5,000 schools under this banner, the Rosewald School in the South. 5,000 schools that was started by the president of Sears and Roebuck, Julius Rosenwald. He and Booker T. Washington were instrumental in establishing all these 5,000 schools. 27 of them now are remaining in PG County. And the first one of the Rosewald Schools was open in PG County on Central Avenue. And ladies and gentlemen, we had an education. We had no idea that it was a fund started by Sears and Roebuck back in 1927. And they started 5,000 schools across the South for Black youth, for Black kids. I want to take my hat off to the Carney family, Jade and
Cameron.
They gave us an education that was off the chain. Thank you both. And to Karen Robinson, Carney, we appreciate you and all them eggs you had all over your house. Lady, if they knew you had that many eggs, then you'd be rich if you could sell them. Thank you. Here we go. How states are undoing criminal justice reform. Louisiana, New York, and other states are rolling back reforms in efforts to reduce excessive sentencing or expand parole on smaller in scope. Louisiana voters go to the poll to consider substantially stiffening juvenile justice laws. The proposal, Constitution Amendment 3, would give state lawmakers new leeway to send teenagers to adult courts, jails, and prisons. Currently, 14 to 16-year-olds can only be charged as adults for the most serious crimes like rape and murder. Advocates for the amendment want the power to add new felonies like the distribution of fentanyl. It's a far cry from the mid-2010s when state legislators advanced a bipartisan law that pulled youth out of the adult criminal justice system, followed by broader sentencing reforms that reduced the state prison population by about a third. Most of those reforms were scraped last year. If today's measure passes, it will further slide the state toward an even more punitive system than the one reformers sought to change a decade ago. Excuse me. Lawmakers in New Mexico also pushed a law this session to expand the list of crimes in which young people could be tried as adults. But the measure failed after youth advocates raised concern. So did an alternative effort that would have expanded intervention and reentry programs for teenagers, but also would have added manslaughter to the charges that could see youth charges add those. In New York, reforms are not on the stall, but are being actively unraveled. Excuse me. Governor Kathy Hochul is backing legislation to scale back portions of the state's 2019 Discovery Reform Law. The proposal would reduce the amount of evidence prosecutors are required to share with defense attorneys before trial and limit judges' ability to dismiss cases over prosecutors' noncompliance. Folks, every time we look, there's laws going on in Maryland, in Virginia, targeting our youth. We all know what the cause is of these kids getting involved. I don't like these guys. This is basically black kids that you're talking about taking the trial as adults, 14, 15, and 16. They're getting 50, 60 years of their life. Why won't we deal with the causes of the problem as opposed to punishing them after they commit the crime? Let's prevent them from doing it in the first place. Also, excuse me, all stick, no carrot. Ohio's Reagan-Tokes law act as a one-way ratchet for prison time. Intended to curb prison violence with promises of early release, the law is turning out as unbalanced as critics feared, with sentences extended at every turn. Hundreds of incarcerated people are denied release from Ohio prisons each year under the Senate Bill 201, better known as the Reagan-Tokes Law. Enacted in 2019, the law was designed to protect the public with a carrot and stick approach to incarceration. It gave prison administrators exclusive power to add time for people who misbehave behind bars or to recommend early release for those who follow the rules. But as critics predicted, the law has only led to longer incarceration. Not a single person has been released early, according to the Marshall Project. Cleveland reviews of prison records for the past 6 years. Meanwhile, 700 people, mostly black men, have been denied release due to added time. When you give this kind of unchecked power to people, it's going to be abused, said one of the defense attorneys who fought for the law's constitutionality to be challenged in the Ohio Supreme Court. Excuse me. The law was a legislative reaction to the 2017 murder of Reagan Tokes, a 21-year Ohio State University student, by a man recently released from prison. This latest pendulum swing in Ohio's criminal sentencing laws created a new class of incarcerated people who wish not only solitary confinement and loss of privilege, but also longer prison stays for violating prison rules. It's a partial return to the indefinite sentencing that Ohio legislators replaced with fixed prison terms. More than 14,500 people, nearly a third of Ohio's current prison population, has been sentenced under the Reagan-Tokes law. Critics argue that with no requirement to notify elected judges before adding some or all of the maximum term, lawmakers handed unchecked extrajudicial power to unelected prison officials who is abusing this, and we are this is what we call jiggy boogie. It's more jiggy boogie than we've ever seen before. And lastly, did your family member die in prison or jail? What happened next? Your insights help inform the Marshall Project's reporting on what families go through when someone dies in custody. A team of reporters at the Marshall Project, a nonprofit newsroom that uses journalism to help make the U.S. criminal legal system more fair, transparent, and human, is looking into what people go through when a relative or close friend dies in custody or shortly after returning home. We want to understand many aspects of the family experience. How did you learn about the death? Were you given clear information about what happened? Were you able to claim your family member's body and personal belongings? Did your family member die in the hospital or soon after being released? If you have any concerns about this, you can call the Marshall Project or email them, custody@themarshallproject.com, or you can check with me and Martina, call later and send us a text, and we'll connect you. But a lot of folks are dying in prison, and a lot of men and women are dying within two to three years after release. This is scary and it's frightening, and nobody's digging into what the source of this is. And lastly, Black Boys Matter. Why are they disappearing from school? Despite rising attention to college and workforce gaps, Black male students continue to be pushed out of K through 12 schools. In March, when the New York Times reported that one in five young Black men between the ages of 20 and 24 are neither in school nor employed. The article noted that Black men make up just 19% of enrollment at Howard University. I'm going to repeat this. Black men make up just 19% of the enrollment at Howard University, one of the nation's most prestigious HBCUs. Opting out of college and the workforce is a symptom of a much larger problem for young Black men, one that begins as early as preschool. Long before college enters the educational picture, the lack of Black men in higher education stems from next to no institutional or emotional support for Black K through 12 school boards, lingering systemic racism in public education, and very few Black male teachers as role models. Our kids are being shoved, stepped on, messed on. And this is some more game we call jiggy boogie, stuff that just ain't right. Now we get to our story, our topic. And our guest this morning is an interesting individual I've been seeing all over Washington, D.C. Every time I go to meetings for returning citizens, when I look up, there's Representative, oh yeah, yeah. This guy is phenomenal. He's the first Nigerian-American who's been elected to office in the federal government. Dr. Oye is a licensed pharmacist, nature explorer, and current U.S. representative of Washington, D.C. Dr. Oye began engaging in neighborhood politics and successfully ran for and was elected advisory neighborhood commissioner for his community. As a commissioner, Dr. Oye planted the flag in the fight for D.C. statehood. The fight for statehood led him to a successful run for U.S. representative. Now, as U.S. representative, his primary focus included improving health care, D.C. statehood, immigration reform, and income inequity. Welcome, Dr. Oye Oluwawu. I hope I got it right.
Yep, you did good, brother. It's good to see you, Rich Brown, and thank you for having me here. You did right.
Excuse me.
No problem.
And of course, we have none other than the world-renowned globetrotting, our right-hand partner. She's back in the States, Nikisha Taissa. Where you been at, lady? We ain't seen you in years.
I'm back. My voice is kind of hoarse, but yeah, I've been out. But I know you and your team been holding down the fort, and I'm really looking forward to hearing our guest today, Representative Oye Oluwawu.
I guess it ain't catchy. That sounds
she got it right.
It's a good night conversational.
Yeah, it's good having you back, Nikisha.
We yes,
our audience miss you. Yeah. So, Dr. Oye, you have been elected as a representative, the U.S. representative. I thought we already had a representative, Congressman Eleanor Holmes Norton, and you are a representative. Can you explain how that works?
I'm so thankful that you asked this question. It's actually the number one question I get regularly. Our Congresswoman, our warrior on the Hill, Delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, is in Congress. She has a campaign staff, congressional staff, and district staff. Me, because D.C. is not a state, my office is actually in the Wilson Building, D.C.'s version of City Hall. Now, we are different in the way of Congresswoman Norton has congressional staff and a seat in Congress and obviously the office on Capitol Hill, and mine's in City Building. But in addition, you know, she has a few more resources at her disposal, but mainly with me, we both fight for D.C. statehood. I go across not only the city, but also this country to talk about statehood, federal legislation impacting D.C. residents, but I do see our delegate as a mentor, as a role model of mine, and we work together to solve some of our local issues here in the district.
So we have two non-voting delegates in Congress, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and you. Is that correct?
So I don't vote in Congress. I don't have a seat at all in Congress at all. Okay. I do have my seat in the Wilson Building, which is the City Hall building. So a little bit differently, sometimes they call my role the shadow representative because yes. I'm more of a placeholding position, but in this role, we made it a lot more impactful because of people like you.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate that clarification. Last week, as usual, I see you almost every other week at some one of these meetings, and you are an activist pharmacist and the elected DC representative. So you're working in the trenches, and you're working in within the legislation. So you got your feet on both sides of the street. Exactly. And I'm going to say thank you for what you're doing. And what you said last week, touched us, because I was looking at this Medicare and Medicaid stuff coming down out of the White House, and how our people, I know folks who are seniors who get maybe $500-$600 a month in Social Security, and their medicine may cost $400-$500. Right. And they got to, what do you do with this high cost of medicine? And we know you remember you as the ANC commissioner from Ward 8, far southeast, and that is the most marginalized community in this city. And I know folks are having trouble buying food, groceries, the SNAP program, and they can't get their medicine. And for you to be a pharmacist and an activist, as well as an elected official, you're working on both sides of the issue at the same time. And I take my hat off to you, because you're in the trenches and you're in the boardrooms. And I want to thank you for working both sides of the street. What is it? How is it impacting our community, those folk who are on very little income, and with Trump's promise of reducing the cost of Medicaid, and special prescription medication? What is your take on this?
Yeah, I appreciate that question as well, because as you mentioned, I do work in Ward 8, but I also live in Ward 8. So, and not just Navy Park Ward 8, I live in Congress Heights, cross street from Alabama Avenue Ward 8. So this is a real, real, real Southeast. And it's important to say that, because I don't just work here, I live here, and I walk these streets and I walk these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And to see folks who are not only scraping by on Medicare and Medicaid, but also seeing the Trump White House threatening to cut Medicaid by $880 million. Now, people have a hard time sometimes conceptualizing that amount of money, but we're talking about people losing their Medicaid. We're talking about people who otherwise would have a bus service paid by their insurance, no longer having those services. So we're really talking about life and death issues. And not only are the specific individuals losing those Medicaid, which is mostly income-based, that's why it's in Ward 7, Ward 8, where socioeconomic factors push people in these areas, we're also talking about the healthcare workers. You know, if we lose these pharmacies, if we lose these healthcare specialty doctors, then we're really cutting people off from resources. And they sometimes call Ward 7, Ward 8 east of the river. I call it east of the 95. Because if you cross that 95, there's a whole totally different city. Yeah. No, yes. Government agencies isn't over here. Most of the restaurants aren't over here. Most of the grocery stores aren't over here. And in a way, the highway segregated us from the other parts of the city. So not to get too long-winded with these answers, but the cut to Medicaid and Medicare will not only cost people their insurance, but may also cost people the only sources of healthcare services. They will lose their hospitals. I mean, we just broke ground on Cedar Hill, but if we lose half of Medicaid recipients in Ward 8, who is going to go to this hospital? Who's going to go from Ward 2, Ward 3, across that 95 to go to the Cedar Hill Hospital? And these are things that I care about, not only as a neighbor, but also someone who literally works in these neighborhoods. I decided to move back to Ward 8, and I feel like it came back at a critical time, because there's so many things that need to be done in this community.
You know, one of the things I'm concerned about is that how many pharmacists are there east of the river in Ward 8? Because I know that is... folks need access to the pharmacist for their medication to stay alive and reduce their pain, et cetera, and be treated. But if folks don't have transportation, and the cost of living going up and the cost of bus rides are going up, everything is going up. How do the folks who are marginalized, who are barely making, because we looked at it, it was like 53 million people in America live at the poverty level or below, 53 million. And there's a thing we read a few days ago, that there's about 25 corporations that receive subsidies, free money from the government. And these are big, huge conglomerates that's making billions, and yet they get $2 billion, $3 billion, $5 billion in subsidies. And yet they can't reduce these costs to bring them down and make it affordable. And you got people who are dying. Also, I wanted to throw in this, Doc, when we had the meeting last week, There are men and women being released from prison. Yeah. When I came out, you got 30 days supply of medication, a couple of a pair of pants, socks, underwear, etc. But you had enough medicine for 30 days until you get a chance to find a medical a provider, etc. What's going on now east of the river with those folk coming out of institutions, and as well as the people who had never been inside, seniors who don't have no money, no transportation, no access to this pharmacy? What do you see can be done as our representative in Congress?
Yeah, thank you for that question. What I see is what I've seen for the past 10, 15, 20, 30 years. People falling between the cracks, right? We're talking about returning citizens who are shipped all across this country because there's no state prison in DC, who are not close to their family members, who don't have real avenues to live a second chance, and to be honest, often have criminal records that keep them from getting the jobs they want to, work, living where they want to, and they often fall back into some of those practices. Maybe not even convicted, not even that they've done. Maybe they got convicted of it. Maybe they took somebody else's charge, and now they're back into those bad situations. So in my office, we created something called the Expungement Clinic, where we help returning citizens get free legal assistance. We're supporting people with some of those basic needs. And most importantly, just listening to people. But back to your question about what happens to those east of the river, whether incarcerated or not, 50% of east of the river residents, Ward 7, Ward 8, do not have a primary care provider.
Say that again, would you? 50%?
50%. One of every two adults living east of the river do not have a family, have a primary care physician.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, wow. Ward 7, Ward 8, the life expectancy is 71 years old. Across the river, 86 years old. People are dying because of the healthcare disparities, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a primary care physician, you're not getting that physical. You're not getting that preventative care. Yes. You're showing up to the emergency room when your stomach is hurting. And next thing you know, you realize you have an ulcer, pancreatitis, or even cancer. So this not only has detrimental effects to our healthcare outcomes, it also costs more money. We're wasting money because people are unable to get preventative care. So in this office, we try to reach out to providers, not only talk to adults, but also talk to children. We're trying to inspire more DC kids, especially those that look like us, to get in these STEM careers, because not only does that impact the economy of the family and the community, it also can protect a parent if your child's a pharmacist, right? If your child's a physician. Yes. So you can get that kind of care. And for the past 11 years, I've been going to elementary schools, training kids into learning, but more importantly, trying to fill that pipeline of soon-to-be healthcare workers with DC kids.
Thank you. And we got our distinguished co-host. It's so glad to have you back, Nikisha Taiga. We miss you, lady. You've been in Mexico. You've been at the UN. Have you been to the moon yet? You've been going everywhere. Unmute.
I was in Ohio at the National Returning Citizens Conference. That's one of the places where I was with Dr. Carlisle Holder and others. And that was a phenomenal event. Next year is going to be in Florida. So hopefully we'll see you there. But I want to ask Representative Oye something. Excuse my voice. I get myself together. But I know the issues with respect to Medicaid, but I'm just curious, is Medicare on the chopping block as well? Social Security, you know, what people have paid into, you know, forever. I'm just curious, what's your sense on that?
Absolutely. This administration is cutting everything. They're going after Social Security. They're going after Medicare. Now, in terms of those two, they might be more protected because that's universal. One good thing about Medicare is regardless of how much money you make, depending on your age, depending on certain health care or health diagnoses, you're eligible for Medicare. So all across this country, you have people in Republican areas, Democratic areas, going to their Congress members and yelling at them. And even more recently, President Trump has spoken in support of keeping Medicare and Social Security because he understands where his bread is buttered. The reason why I'm so concerned about Medicaid, I'm sure you all know this, Medicaid is not age-specific, it's income-specific. Mm. And when they talk about Medicaid, they usually point at people that look like me and you and say we don't deserve it. And even though by and large, more white people use Medicaid than Medicare, it could be used as a source of cultural division and racist politicking. So I'm very, very concerned about Medicaid as well as Medicare and Social Security, but I'm really aptly paying attention to Medicaid because that's easier politically to cut. That affects people that looks like me and you. And I live in Ward 8 where 27% of the adults in Ward 8 have a college degree, whereas 66% of the entire city has college degrees. Wow. Now, I'm not saying everybody needs to have a college degree to have a wealthy living or to be able to survive in DC. There's other avenues as well, but it shows the type of economic disparities. I mean, the average income holder in Ward 8 is $40,000. The other part of the city is $150,000+. So we see what happens when you punch down on poor people, when you punch down on lower income people. And even me, who I don't consider myself to be lower income, I live in this community, so I still have one grocery store. I still only have one hospital, whereas people on the other side have three or four in walking distance.
Wow, this is amazing. These numbers that you spoke about, I know that one of the things that President Trump campaigned on was lowering the prescription drug prices and the cost of prescription drug prices. And we have you seen anything yet since he's been in office for the first 100 days in terms of making any effort to reduce these high costs of prescription medication?
This would be the shortest answer I give all day. He lied. Right. So President Biden, he negotiated a few drugs, in my opinion, not enough, but a few drugs like insulin to be lower cost with Medicare. President Trump has had no inklings of doing any such work. He has not increased the drugs that are going to be covered. In fact, he is slashing Medicare. He is slashing Medicaid. He has slashed Social Security. He's making eggs more expensive when he said that those were the first thing he was going to do. And he's launching tariffs just to make the headlines. So he's not really interested in governing in this way. He's not interested in alleviating the cost of millions of people. It is up to folks like us to make the change, right? Like as a pharmacist, as a community servant, as a radio host, just speaking truth to power and making sure we find ways for folks to live comfortably and with dignity is something that we all need to do. It's not just a president, it's not just a mayor, it's not just a council. We all have to do it collectively.
I'm glad you said that you reside in Ward 8. You was an advisory neighborhood commission from Ward 8. You got elected as a House of Representatives non-voting delegate to Congress. You're the first African Nigerian elected to federal office. Yeah. And you were working on both sides of the street. You were in the streets and in the boardroom. And I take my hat off to you. And my question is, what is it for those folk, man, who are on public assistance or just barely hanging on, and they can't afford their medication? Is there any outlet or relief or source they can go to if somebody's medication is $600-$800 and a check from Social Security is $500? They're in trouble. What can they do? Or what would you suggest that our listeners who are in need of their medication but don't have the resources to purchase them? So what would you suggest to them to do?
Seek help. Talk to your pharmacist. Talk to your doctor. Really try to find better ways and opportunities for you to afford your medications. And interestingly enough, people talk about medication affordability, but they don't always talk about medications that are covered by their insurance. And I'll give you an example. I don't want to get too far in the weeds because I'm a pharmacist. I can get really, really, really down the rabbit hole. But for example, Medicaid has something called MCOs, Managed Care Organizations. And what that basically means is a subset of Medicaid you belong to. So there's AmeriHealth, there's Amerigroup, and other types of Medicaid insurance. Think of like different brands of a car, right? And this actually happened to one of my patients about a couple of years ago. Those managed care organizations operate like different brands of vehicles. So one's a Toyota brand, one's a Nissan brand, one is a Ford brand. And they don't always cover the same medications. And for the most part, the people who sign up for these branded Medicaids don't know what they cover. So for example, I had a lady who got insulin, right? And that insulin was covered by the Ford brand of Medicaid, but she was transitioned over to the Toyota brand. And that brand didn't cover that insurance. I mean, that insulin wasn't covered by the other insurance. So she kept having her blood sugar go higher and higher and higher because she was taking her insulins, But she was telling her doctor I was taking the medicine. Because, of course, who's going to say they're not? But because I wasn't communicating enough with the doctor's office, and it wasn't that real way of having freaking communication, when she finally was able to get that medication covered, she not only missed all those doses increasing her blood sugar, but now her doctor increased the dosage to bring it down. So now that she's taking this insulin, she is now spiking low levels of blood sugar because she's now taking a higher dosage. She ends up in the hospital. She's now having bad consequences of that insulin. And then she said, you know what? I don't want to take this anymore. So you can see how the ping pong and effect of her own health is impacted just because one insurance isn't covering that insulin. So it's not just about affordability. It's also about drug coverage. And that's something that's simple. That's something that can save lives. And that's something that really impacts the Black community because we have a higher rates of diabetes compared to other races, especially in the district.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Come on, my better half.
Caller, I think
that's... Wait a minute, before we take the call, go ahead.
Okay, this is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. We want to encourage you to join us this Friday for the 48th anniversary celebration of WPFW. And Still We Rise. We're going to be dancing. There are going to be performances, poetry, dinner included, a cash bar. Come on out. You can get your tickets online at WPFW 48th Anniversary Celebration at Martin's Crosswinds this Friday night, 6:30 p.m. in Greenbelt, Maryland. Come and join us. Meet all the programmers, all the hosts, and support this cause and have fun at the same time.
And the phone number is 202-588-0893, 202-588-0893. And we will take our first caller. You want to add, please, question or comment?
Merry Christmas.
And happy Groundhog Day to you.
I'm gonna explain myself. I think I made it a little bit further than the groundhog. You're glad that you have this distinguished guest on today. I'm surprised or somewhat puzzled how he escaped our frame of view over here in Ward 8. I was a pharmacy technician for a lot of years in my career and have some familiarity with the Apothecary Inn. So glad, pleased to meet you by radio and phone, sir.
And your name is?
My name is R.G. I'm surprised you didn't recognize my voice, Roach.
Well, I'm getting old, R.G. I'm having a Kool-Aid this morning.
Hey, look, don't never take that hat off. Then I really see how old you are.
I sleeps in it. I don't take it off.
All right. Roach always authoritative, on point, relevant man to the team, man. It's just a great credit to WPFW, to the community. But my question to the guest involved, what is his take and position on, first of all, the annoying and a barrage of phone calls from these Medicare supplement plans with a food card and all of this, and whether or not these are legitimate? Second question, what is the current median income for pharmacists and technicians? And three, what about the formulary? They're constantly adjusting medications that they cover and do not cover, which is a real problem for people as they age. Those are my questions.
You have any questions, but not many questions. I'm going to give you your own show. Can you come in? Come on. Hey, you got it.
Fourth
hour.
Hey,
Bob, you got it.
Look, I love you and your beautiful wife, too, Roach, so it's all good.
Thank you, man. Thank you, RG. Thank you, buddy.
Absolutely. I'll try to answer those questions completely succinctively. So, number one, I believe you're talking about the annoying supplemental Medicare calls. I think they've reduced in the last few years. I think they're starting to bug the doctors a little bit more and some of the patients directly. But they are, some of these drug reps and insurance plans, they make their money off of creating a relationship with pharmacies and thereof. So maybe potentially we could talk to patients about them, which we're not allowed to do. We're not allowed to steer patients to insurance. Insurance is oriented to even physicians, but if they want to create a relationship, they think it will help their odds of being picked. Number two, I believe the question was about the salary between pharmacists and pharmacy techs. Now, since I began as a pharmacist, I believe that pharmacy technicians should be paid more, even if it means that pharmacists get paid a little bit less. Pharmacy technicians are the lifeblood of the pharmacy. They do practically almost every single thing. The pharmacist is there to make sure there's no mistakes and liability, but the pharmacy technicians are lifeblood. Certain companies pay different prices depending on relationships, or not even relationships, but like experiences and whatnot, but they're really rarely between like the $18 range and $30 range, depending on where it is. Pharmacists are a little bit higher, between 40 to 60, depending on the things I mentioned as well, where you're working and whatnot. Now, the last question was about how drugs are paid by insurance, I believe. I think that was his question. There's something called PBMs, pharmacy benefit managers. They belong to insurances. They're supposed to be the middleman between drug companies and insurances and the pharmacy. But these PBMs with time has gotten a lot stronger, and they're basically taking money from both sides and becoming very powerful middlemen. I'm not sure if you see those commercials from drug pharma companies where they finally now releasing ads against PBMs, because they're the ones who decide what's covered and what's not covered. When I talked about that lady whose insulin's issue was causing her health outcomes to change, that was because pharmacy benefit managers that work on behalf of the insurances are deciding what they pay for and what they don't pay for. And that's usually not because of efficacy, it's usually because of cost and pricing. They want to save as much money possible so they can keep more dividends and rewards and revenue while everybody else suffers for it. So Congress is now starting to take notice of it, but this is the reason why healthcare workers should be in office, because you don't have to lobby a seat that you already sit in. You don't have to find people to give you legislation to put forward because you lack this firsthand information. And I really implore folks who are healthcare workers to really consider running for office, because when we're in these seats, we can have better conversations.
Okay, thank you. You also our representative, our second representative in Congress. Have you submitted any legislation or talked to anybody in Congress to see what you can do to help support some of the things we're talking about in reducing the high cost of prescription drugs, and also about them PBMs? Because I know a few guys who are PBMs, and they're making tons of money as the middleman between the pharmaceutical company and the pharmacist and the patient. And they get theirs off the top. And as you said, the Ford, the Chevrolet, each medication, depending on who provides it, is at a different price. Ooh. And the generic price, the generic is always different. So it's what can we do to combat this or to fight this, man, to make sure that we can get a fair treatment? Because we got people who are dying, and they ain't got a choice between the medication or the food or the rent. And absolutely, they don't have enough for either or.
Right. Yeah, in terms of lobbying advocacy, I believe it's not just in Congress. We've gone state level, we've gone even lower. I've had conversations with council members in D.C. I've had conversations on the Hill. But I also worked with organizations dedicated to fight this very matter. And we've gone to different states to do so. New Jersey, Texas, D.C., New York, because healthcare, in my opinion, is a human right. It's an American right. Right. How much you have, regardless of where you live, you should have access to medication that can keep you alive. And you shouldn't have middlemen who are invisible controlling what you can have and what you cannot have. Now, and I also think that the pricing should be fair. It should be transparent. You shouldn't go to a hospital and 3 weeks later you get a bill for an amount you can't pay. Medical debt is the number one reason why Americans are going bankrupt. And I don't think that's right.
You said medical debt.
It's called bankruptcy. It's not business. It's not student loans. It's medical debt. Because when you're taken to the hospital, you can't price shop. You can't say, I don't want the MRI. You get the MRI, you get a bill three weeks later. I'm guaranteeing you, if you knew how much things cost at the point of sale, like it is when you buy a tire or groceries, you might be able to make a different decision. And sometimes doctors, even to their best inclination, they just say, you know, we need to run this extra test just to make sure. And nothing comes of it, but now you have a bill for $5,000. That's what happened to me when I was in a car accident. Like, I had a bill that, you know, I didn't know what was coming out of it. So there are things that I've experienced. And if I've experienced it, I know other people are as well.
Yes,
but
yes.
To get back to the advocacy, anybody and everybody should be made aware of this issue.
What are some of the policies coming out of the Trump administration that would affect pharmacists that you've seen? I know he's talking about changing Medicaid or messing with Medicaid, Medicare. What are some of the things that his policies that you've seen since he's been in for the first 100 days that's affecting the pharmacy and his operation?
Well, first and foremost, from his first administration 45 years ago, which seems like 1,000 years ago because his last 3 months seems like 3 years, to be honest. He wants to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. He wants to get rid of Obamacare. He said he had a great plan for it. When we asked him, he said, we'll get back to you. If you remove healthcare from 50 million people, that already alone ruins or severely interferes with our healthcare process. Cutting Medicaid, Medicare, cutting food stamps affects our healthcare process and system. But you know, Roach, every little thing about our life affects our health. It's not yes. just how we pay for our medicines, it's about how we live. It's about our water quality. It's about our public safety. It's about how we provide employment for people who were recently incarcerated or provide employment for people who are recently laid off from the federal government. All those things impact our healthcare. So we need to make sure that we share all those things at the same time as we're talking about our healthcare industry or our insurance industry. Now, in my opinion, I think we need to shore up so many different things. Employment for people, higher wages, safer communities. I'm working on bringing drug take-back bins for us to remove our unused prescription pills from home to keep our kids safe. We talked about fentanyl, but most of those abused medications come from the household. So we're finding ways to get rid of those supplies of unused medication. We'll be saving young people's lives because they can't get high off of medications that's not available to them. So all those things impact our healthcare crisis.
Okay, we'll take the next caller. All right, our next caller, question or comment, please, and your name?
Hey, is it me?
Yes.
You are.
Yes, you are.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, my name is Dave, and I just wanted to call and comment and ask a question. The information that you're giving is second to none because I work in the field myself. I've been a pharmacist for like almost 50 years now, and it's all about preventing and helping. My question to you, can you please talk about the foundational assistance that's available for people? There are a lot of foundations out there that really help people a lot, but they don't
come out to the
store.
Okay, Doc. You got it.
The question was organizations that support people. And similar to my last answer, you know, anything that improves the quality of life of DC residents and beyond improves healthcare. But specific to healthcare, my good friend, Dr. Ambrose Lane runs the Healthcare Alliance.
Yes.
My dear friend, Duclis Charles, he runs something called the Black Health Connect. Every year, a bunch of healthcare workers from our backgrounds come to DC. Now they're trying to get more involved, helping seniors and providing people in marginalized communities with free, no cost volunteering healthcare. We have Anacostia Coordinating Council. You know, yes. They're more of a civic organization, but every week they have a newsletter with 15 free events to go to that really aimed at helping the community. But living in Ward 8, living in Southeast Washington, DC, I say we're the most diverse community. Not based off of race alone, because that's what people usually look at, but also how we consume information. You can't just send a newsletter and expect to reach everybody, because you will just see the same people. You can't expect the same people to always go to the Wilson Building, because that's another part of the city with no parking, right? And we're not afforded the same privilege of being able to take a bike ride down to the Wilson Building. So when I say we're the diverse community, some people need to there's doors knocked. Some people need to be spoken to in their church. Some people need to be spoken to in their mosque because that's how you reach them. So there are a lot of great services southeast and northeast, including the CRUSE program, where they really try to work to reduce
that's right.
crime and improve public safety. But what we need to do, in my opinion, what I've been able to do and how I've been able to reach more people is literally knocking on doors, talking in grocery stores, standing outside where you're not comfortable, talking to a group of 5-6 guys that you don't know because one of them is listening. And then one of them will go to your event and tell the other 5 people that they need to show up too. Just making sure that we reach one, we teach one, and we don't leave anyone behind, because some people may need 2, 3, 4, 5 times of being talked to before they say, you know what? I have a free Wednesday, I have a free Tuesday, I have a free Monday. Let me go to that program that Roche Brown told me about, because those are the people that aren't going to be reached the same way as other people are being reached.
Let me throw this in. We got another call on the second part of this question you asked in terms of what foundations or whatever is supporting this lack of prescription drugs. Is there a mobile van or is there some source and some resource you can go to for those folk who are in need of emergency pharmacists' help or medication, and they don't have Medicaid, Medicare, they don't know where to go or who to turn to? Is there any source? That's part of what I think the gentleman was at.
Oh, gotcha. Yes. So there's some organizations, the Whitman Walker. They typically support people of the LGBTQ plus community, but they don't turn anybody away. They do free testing. I do believe they also do some free medications at certain times. I will have to look up to see if there are any vans. I know there's some member vans that the DC Mayor's Office of Women and Policy Initiative sometimes collaborate with. I will forward you some more information from the PG County side, because I do believe there might be a little more services in Maryland. But not to discount things that happen in DC, there are a lot of people trying to work to tackle this issue, and I'll get you some of their names shortly.
Thank you. And you mentioned Ambrose Lane. He's on the show. His father used to be Ambrose Lane Sr., and Ambrose has been sick and under the weather. Yeah, we send our prayers and our best wishes out to Ambrose, because he's very knowledgeable and informed on all aspects of this medical issue.
Absolutely.
And get well soon, Ambrose. Your turkey will be waiting on you. We'll take our next caller, please. You want to add a question or comment? Hello, next caller.
Hi, Roach.
Yes.
Hi, this is Dr. Edwin Chapman.
Well, hello, Doc. I knew you'd be calling. This is the man here. Come on in.
Yes.
Come on.
You know, we were all at the great event at Metropolitan AME Church a week or two ago.
Yes.
And speak out.
All of us spoke. And I mentioned the fact that my practice, which is the largest private opioid treatment practice in the city, is being terminated by one of the 3 Medicaid MCOs because I complained because one of my, 13 of my patients at the beginning of the year were denied branded buprenorphine. One of those patients, wrote, you know very well.
Yes.
He's a gentleman that's been on your show. He has 2 sons. He's somewhat in
Nate, Nate Morris.
Yeah, so he was one of those 13 patients, and so he couldn't get his medications for days. Now the insurance company is terminating my contract because I raised hell about those 13 patients, and there were actually 40 patients altogether who received letters.
Jesus.
This was illegal. This was illegal because as of 2019, the D.C. City Council said that patients could get branded or generic any form of buprenorphine that they needed to treat their opioid addiction. So this is the kind of stuff that's going on. That's why doctors don't want to treat. That's why doctors are leaving the city. And everybody in the health department knows about it. But they are not, but they came after me.
Help you, Doc.
Yes.
What can us and our listeners do to help you, Doc?
So I would like to, for us to meet with Dr. Oye. And Nikichi would be the perfect person because this is a class action lawsuit. These people have no business. These are for-profit companies that come into our community, and the only thing they're interested in is making money. And
money.
That's why we're getting such terrible outcomes in healthcare.
Okay. So you want to arrange a meeting with Dr. Ole and the teacher, and I guess you're going to be your good buddy, Dr. Waldo, because you got to be there to see what
got
we can
it, do. Brother. Let me know what I can do to support. You got it.
Well, just give me a call, Doc, and we'll call Dr. Oye, and we get the necessary people, and we can meet at your office, or we can meet at McDonald's if they don't want to charge us for coming in. Because we went to McDonald's last week, me and my wife and my grandkid, and we spent $31. I told the people, I'm not trying to buy the joint. I just want a hamburger. So let us know, Doc, because you are my favorite doctor. We need you. You're doing valuable work, and you need all the help and support you. And I know people you've been working with for 15, 20 years, and you still your patients, and you still got a working relationship with them. So this man, just like our guest, Dr. Oye, Dr. Chapman is in the streets. He's in his office. He's in the community meetings. You got activist doctors we talked about this morning.
Right.
Representative Oye, Dr. Chapman, and these doctors not just talking and walking the walk. They are there, they make community meetings, they have medical appointments, and they keep all their appointments with their patients, but they still find time to come to the community to find out what the pulse is in that community and what they can do to help. So whatever we can do with them, anybody that's listening who is knowledgeable about this particular field, if you got any insight of what we can do to help Dr. Chapman, because this guy is saving lives. I go about at least two, three times a week and see the people outside and around. So we need Dr. Chapman, and he need our support. So whatever anybody can do or got any information, please share it so we can help this help our patients.
Community.
We're all patients of each other. I'm your patient, you're my patient. So whatever we can do to help each other, let's do it. Nikisha, it seems like you've got something you want to say.
Oh, no, I was just saying, I liked when you mentioned about activist doctors, activist lawyers, activist pharmacists. I mean, we need to be activists, radio programming. We need to be activists, everything, particularly in this climate. So I'm glad that you lifted that up. And I know you mentioned McDonald's, but you know, we need to deal with Ben's Chili Bowl. That's what
Yes, right. You know, we got 2 minutes, and we got, for folks who are listening, every first Tuesday of each month, we come to you live for a two-hour show from Vince Chili Bowl on U Street, and we have a live audience. So if you want to come by and be in the audience while we do the show on the first Tuesday of each month from 10 to 12, it's a two-hour show. We used to have breakfast, but it stopped during the COVID, so we haven't regrouped at the Chili Bowl to have breakfast. So we're just doing a radio show in the back room of Vince Chili Bowl for the first Tuesday of each month from 10 to 12. You're welcome to come to join us. Dr. Representative Oye, I'm going to thank you for joining us. You got about 30 seconds to give us some closing remarks, Doc.
Absolutely. I first want to thank you so much for allowing me on your platform. I want to send my 100% support behind Dr. Chapman as well. But the key thing is that we have each other, right? We have to stand up for each other. Because if we don't, nobody else will.
There you go.
And last but not least, Roche, I mean, I want to thank you for your continued activism for East of the River, returning citizens, and all of D.C. beyond. You represent D.C.
Where's your pharmacy located at?
I work at the Giant Pharmacy on Alabama Avenue. A cool walk down the street, you know? Nothing like walking to work every morning.
Well, you're the pharmacy on Alabama Avenue where the Giant is.
Exactly. I used to work in Capitol Hill, but I decided that it's important for me to work and serve my direct neighbors.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right, we give them a number for people to call, and if anybody need to contact you.
Yeah, I can put my email there. I can even put my cell phone number out there. I really want to be transparent.
Give me your phone number. Your phone number will be fine.
My number. All right. This is my direct phone number right here. 202-390-9480. Please text me your name, because if you just write hello, I won't know who it is. Again, it's 202-390-9480. That's me.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Doc. We're going to have you back on, and please listen to what Dr. Chapman said. We need our support.
Yes.
Anybody got any suggestions we can do to help Dr. Chapman? Because he's saving lives, and don't even worry about the cause or who it is. This man's life is on the line because he goes in neighborhoods. A lot of people won't go in. So we had two activists, a pharmacist and an activist doctor. Boy, y'all are doing a tremendous work, Dr. Chapman and Dr. Oye. Thank you both. And we have you back on in the very immediate future. And thanks to our returning co-host who we missed so badly. Thank you for being back with us, Nikisha Taifa. So this has been Crossroads, and this has been Mertine, and I love this woman. I don't know. I just love her to death. I told her, I said, if something happens and they make a mistake and they send me up to heaven if I pass, I got one question to ask Jesus. You know what that is?
What is
it? Is Mertine here yet? I'm not coming in unless we're going in together. So we'll say thank you for tuning in to Crossroads. Remember, your inner voice is never wrong. See you next week. Merry Christmas.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
And this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW is celebrating its 48th year, April 25th, 6:30 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds.
Vocalist Navasha Dea will perform, and James Funk will be on the ones and twos.
Longtime programmer Vaughn Martin, artivist Ayanna Gregory, and civil rights activist Dr. Joyce Ladner and Latoysha Brown, all of them will be honored that night.
Zain Al-Amin and Esther Iverum will share poetry.
It'll be an evening of community, music, poetry, and dancing with the WPFW family.
Tony Carr, Bill Wax, Kamal Harris, Craig Williams, Roach and Mertine Brown, Tim Masters,
Violetta Diamond, Joni Eisenberg, Kim Bay, Verna Avery Brown, Ida Campbell, just to name a few of the programmers who will be hosting tables.
Details at wpfwfm.org.
In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the end of the U.S. war in Vietnam, Busboys and Poets, along with the Institute for Policy Studies, will host Vietnamese poet and novelist Nguyen Phan Ke Mai in conversation with Vietnam veteran Wayne Carlin in a program moderated by E. Ethelbert Miller on Thursday, April 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. At the event, 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, Ke Mai will read from her new book of poems, The Color of Peace, and Wayne will read from his latest book, Memorial Days, Vietnam Stories, 1973 to 2022. That's 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, Thursday, April 24th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Tacoma Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP can be found online, ips-dc.org/events. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. In detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country.